Theodore Roosevelt once said, "Do what you can with what you have, right where you are." You have the ability to start your own business right now, right where you are in your current situation, no matter what it is. The most important quality that you must have for success as an entrepreneur is an intense, burning desire to be in a business of your own. If you back your desire with drive and ambition and surround it with the self-discipline to do what you know you should do, when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not, you'll be on your way. These qualities of character are far more important than the temporary advantages of having plenty of money. Most people who dream of starting their own businesses complain that they would like to do it, but they don't have the money. When I was growing up and right into my 30s, I had a dream of achieving financial independence, just like you. But it seemed that I never had enough money, even to pay my bills. As I looked around me, I found that most people were in pretty much the same situation. Most people spend everything they make and a little more besides. And even if a good business opportunity did come along, they wouldn't be able to take advantage of it. This is why in an earlier session I emphasized how important it is that you begin to save 10% of your net income. This is the measure of how much desire, drive, and discipline you really have. The world is full of people who are wishing and hoping, but not doing anything about it. It's only when you are willing to sacrifice in the short term to be prepared for your opportunity in the long term that you begin to make any progress. In this session, I'm going to give you a variety of ways that you can get the money you need to start the business that you want to start. I'll begin by saying that most of the greatest fortunes in America were started on a shoestring. Andrew Carnegie, who built U.S. Steel and became one of the nation's richest men, began as a Scottish immigrant with only 75 cents in his pocket. John D. Rockefeller, who became the world's richest man, began as a clerk earning $3.75 a week. Many men and women started at menial jobs and then managed to pull themselves up through their own efforts to achieve great wealth and total financial independence. It's not the amount of money that you start with, but the amount of ambition and determination that you have that will determine your success. The most important investment you can make in your new business is what is called sweat equity. This is where you invest your time and hard work, 10, 12, or 14 hours a day, 7 days per week for months or even years. But you can translate this sweat equity into real wealth if you stay at it long enough. The starting point of your new business is the idea or concept of the business. Before you do anything, you have to find something that you can get excited about. You have to find something that you really want to sell, that you really want people to take advantage of. You have to have an idea that is so powerful that you become absolutely determined to bring it to the marketplace and make it a success. The second step is the preparation of a detailed business plan. Please do not underestimate the importance of this document. Don't be in too much of a hurry. Take your time. As Shakespeare said, make haste slowly. Take enough time to do your homework and learn all the details of the best way to build your business is through the method known as bootstrapping. With bootstrapping, you start small and invest your time rather than your money or someone else's. You work hard to sell your product and then you plow all of your profits back into the business. You only grow the business out of your positive cash flow. You bootstrap or pull yourself up through your own hard work rather than doing it through the raising of capital from outside sources. Businesses that are built on bootstrapping sometimes grow more slowly than businesses that have ample financial resources, but there's a distinct advantage to bootstrapping that other businesses don't have. When you're pulling yourself up hour by hour and dollar by dollar, you tend to be smarter and learn faster in your business than if you have a cushion of cash to fall back on. If you have very little money, you become far more creative in generating sales and keeping your costs under control than you would if you felt that you could absorb a few mistakes. One of the best ways to bootstrap yourself into business is by becoming a multi-level or network marketer. You can get into a multi-level marketing business with very little money out of your own pocket. All you should have to buy is a sample kit and some basic manuals. From then on, you can make sales from your samples, collect the money, pick up the product, and then deliver it to your customer. Many fortunes are being made every year in America by men and women who started with no money at all in a multi-level marketing business, and by virtue of their hard work, were able to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps into financial independence. And here's an important point. Many people think that they're too good to sell multi-level marketing products. They feel that they are too well-educated or too intelligent. Well, I must tell you that I know many people who barely have their high school diplomas who are making $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 per month by working hard in multi-level marketing businesses. There are many doctors, dentists, architects, engineers, and lawyers who are leaving their professions and going into multi-level marketing because they see the tremendous opportunities to start and build a self-perpetuating money machine. The fact is that successful entrepreneurs are never afraid to do what is called dog work. They're never afraid to roll up their sleeves and do the hard, dirty work that's necessary to get any business off the ground. They're willing to sweep floors, load boxes, and make midnight deliveries if necessary, if that's what it takes to build their businesses. Remember, to start your own business with regard to money, all you have to do is have enough to get started. You don't have to have enough money to compete with General Motors or IBM. You just need to do a reasonable, conservative business plan and then gather sufficient capital to launch your enterprise. One of the primary ways that entrepreneurs begin is with savings or the sale of personal assets. Thousands of successful businesses have been started by individuals who sold or mortgaged their homes, sold their boats and their personal possessions, and even liquidated everything they had in order to get the cash to start. You may have life insurance that has a cash surrender value that you can turn in or borrow against. You may have savings bonds put aside for a rainy day. You may have assets around the house that you can sell for the cash that you need to get started. A good exercise is for you to sit down and make a list of every single thing that you own, and then go over the list and decide which of these things are worth giving up in exchange for being able to start and build your own successful business. Remember, everything requires sacrifice, and starting your own business will often require the greatest sacrifices of your life. Many successful businesses in America have been started and built on credit cards and the cash advances that you can get from them. I've met many men and women throughout the country who started and built their businesses by using their credit cards, and I've had to survive on cash advances from credit cards myself on at least two occasions. The third source of money that's available to you is to borrow against something you own. Often a bank will lend you money against your car if it's almost paid off. You can borrow against your furniture or your boat or any other large possession that you own. Many entrepreneurs borrow to the hilt against their homes to get the cash they need to get started. A major source of money to start new businesses is what is called love money. Love money is money that people give to you because they love you. Love money comes from your parents, your closest relatives, your brothers and sisters, and your friends. Perhaps 99% of new businesses in America are started on personal savings and love money, for the simple reason that this is the only place that you're going to be able to raise money without a successful business track record or assets to sell or borrow against. Often your business associates and the contacts that you've developed during the course of your work and your career will take a chance on you by investing in your business. When I've borrowed love money from my friends and relatives at various times, I've personally guaranteed each loan and paid them an above-market rate of interest, such as 20%, for the life of the loan. Sometimes your friends and relatives will want you to sell them a share of your business. This is not a good idea, but if you do, write out an agreement with a sliding scale of share prices that enables you to buy them out at a profit if the business is successful. Here's another important rule. Don't take partners. If you recall earlier, I recommended either a sole proprietorship or an incorporation as the legal structure for your business. I said nothing about partnerships, and for a good reason. Partnerships are the very worst kind of business arrangement. Partnerships have such a high failure rate that you can be almost guaranteed that they will end in disaster. What happens in most partnerships is one person puts in more and one person puts in less. Then, one person works harder and the other person works less. Pretty soon, one of the partners feels that he or she is being victimized, and this is often true. It's very rare to find two people who are willing to work equally hard to make a business successful. One of the partners will invariably want to take more time off during the course of building the business, and this will increase the level of resentment by the partner who stays to work. Business partnerships are often entered into because two people like each other and think it would be a neat idea to start a business together. These business partnerships, when they end, usually ruin the friendship and the relationship between the partners and their families, sometimes forever. The only time that a business partnership is justified is when the partners have complementary skills and ability. One person may be good on the technical side, while another is good on the marketing and sales side. In 1939, for example, William Hewlett and David Packard formed a business partnership which became the Hewlett-Packard Corporation. Each of these men had skills and abilities that the other lacked, but together they formed the ideal top management team, and they went on to build one of the most successful companies in history. But these exceptions are rare. The basic rule holds true. Don't take partners. The reason that you're going into business is so that you can have freedom and autonomy, so that you can be the master of your own ship and totally in control of your financial future. Don't take partners. The next kind of money that you can get is personal loans from your banker based on your credit history and your personal collateral. You can get a personal line of credit or even a home equity line of credit while you're fully employed working at another job. In credit approvals, 2 years is the magic number. When you've been working for a company for 2 years and living in the same place for 2 years, you can suddenly get all kinds of credit, from credit cards and charge cards in department stores up through and including all kinds of personal loans simply backed by your own personal guarantee. The time to put all of your personal loans in place is before you leave your current job. Once you've borrowed the money, they're not likely to demand it back unless you're late in making your payments. So you can borrow to the maximum on just the strength of your name and your repayment history while you're still employed at your current company. And here's another rule. Guard your credit rating as a sacred thing. You have the right to demand a transcript of your complete credit rating from the credit bureau in the city where you live. You should examine your credit rating at least once a year, and most definitely before you start off to build your own business. Your credit rating becomes terribly important when you need to get any kind of financing as an entrepreneur. If there are any black marks on your credit rating, do everything that you possibly can to remove them. Here are some tips for you on how to borrow from your bank, as a business person and especially as a person building a small business. First of all, remember that entrepreneurs may be risk takers, but bankers are not. Bankers are inherently conservative. They are successful to the degree to which they avoid risk in their lending practices. The purpose of a commercial bank and the job of the lending officer is to make good loans. The banker that you talk to is judged by his superiors solely on the basis of the number of quality loans that he or she makes. If the banker makes a loan that goes bad, and many, many loans to small businesses do go bad, the banker will get a black mark on his record that will affect his pay scale, his position in the bank, and his likelihood of being promoted. So the easiest thing for a bank lending officer to do is to say no, because if he says no, there's no way that he can make a bad loan. He avoids risk by not making the loan in the first place. This is something you must be aware of when you go in. However, the good news is that bankers are in the business of making loans, and if you can convince them that there is no risk in lending to you, they may give you some of the money you need. Once you decide to go into business on your own, select your bank carefully. Interview several bank managers or senior lending officers in advance of opening an account. When you visit the banks, tell them that you're going to be starting a new business and that you're looking for a bank where you can open your accounts and keep your money. Ask them what their policies are towards small businesses and what their lending practices are, and especially their lending authority. Every loan officer and bank executive in every bank branch has what is called a lending limit. This is the amount that they are allowed to approve as a loan without recourse to higher authority. Some junior lending officers have a lending limit as low as $10,000. It's a good idea in your conversations and during your research to ask each of the bankers that you speak to what their lending limit is. They'll usually tell you honestly if you ask them. The most important thing in dealing with a banker is the chemistry between you and the banker. The quality of the interaction, the relationship between the two of you, is perhaps the most important single factor in your decision about which bank to use and which banker to deal with. You must feel very comfortable and friendly toward the banker, and the banker must feel the same way toward you, or you may be getting into more trouble than you're looking for. Many businesses have been shut down by bankers who suddenly decided that they didn't particularly like the business owner. There have been several lawsuits triggered by these seemingly arbitrary behaviors, but the bottom line is that your job is to make sure that you get along well with the banker before you take out a loan, and then maintain the relationship afterwards. When you have finished interviewing different banks, you then make your selection and proceed to open your personal checking, your savings, and your company account, and then invite the banker that you've selected out to lunch. During the lunch, tell him about your business plans. Have your completed business plan, your personal financial statements showing your assets, your liabilities, and your net worth, and your next year's budget projections to leave with him. Go over this material briefly and then let him look at it for a few days. Bankers have a process by which they evaluate a business plan. They have access to a good deal of confidential information on different types of businesses, and after you leave, they'll compare your financial projections with what they think would be reasonable to expect in that business or industry. One of the best rules in dealing with a bank is to ask for money when you don't need it. Once you've borrowed the money, repay it promptly. I once knew a successful entrepreneur who began borrowing and repaying money over a period of 3 years before he started his own business. He would purchase a certificate of deposit for $1,000 in a bank. Then he would go to the lending officer and pledge the certificate of deposit as collateral for a $1,000 loan. This is a very easy loan to get approved. He would then take the $1,000 out of the bank and take it across the street and leave it in another bank for 30 days. Then he would come back and repay the entire amount plus interest. He would come back a month later to borrow $2,000, and then later a $5,000 loan, and over the course of 2.5 years, he was able to work up to a $25,000 unsecured loan based on his perfect record of repayment. This is something you might do to build up a strong credit history before you go out on your own. When you open your account, request a personal line of credit. Whenever possible, meet and deal with a bank manager rather than with a lending officer. And if you must deal with a lending officer, ask to be referred to a senior lending officer. Banks look for 5 essential factors when thinking about approving a loan. They are called the 5 C's of loan approval or disapproval. First, they look at your character, your background, and your reputation. They want to know who you are, where you've worked, and what you've done. Where did you go to school, and where do you live? What is your general reputation in the community? Second, they look for your capacity or your ability to repay the loan. Banks place a high value on your proven ability to earn a respectable amount of money. If you've worked and earned a good living for several years, this demonstrates to the bank that you have the capacity to generate sufficient cash flow to repay a personal or business loan. The third factor that the banks look at is your collateral. These are the assets that you have that you can put up to secure the loan. It's not uncommon for a bank to initially require as much as 5 times the amount of the loan in the form of collateral. The very least that any bank will lend against is 2-to-1. This means that you must have $2 worth of collateral that the bank can attach or put a lien on for every dollar that they'll be willing to lend you. If you have no track record at all in business, especially with a particular bank, the bank might require $3 or $4 or $5 of collateral for every dollar that they will lend you. Remember, their primary concern is making good loans. A good loan is one where they get back all their principal plus interest. Banks also look for what is called the primary source of repayment and then the secondary source of repayment. When a business person asks for a business loan, he attempts to prove that the main or primary source of repayment will be the cash flow from the business. The bankers look at that, and then they want to see, although they seldom say it, your secondary source of repayment. In other words, how will the bank get its money back if your business fails completely? Most loan applications from business people are turned down because the bankers are not convinced that the cash flow from the business is sufficient to assure that the bank will be repaid. Whenever possible, be ready to offer a secondary source of repayment, either from the sale of other assets or income from other sources. The fourth factor that the banks look for is your capital. They will want to know how much you are personally planning to invest in this business. They want to know that you have what is called hurting money in the business. They want to see that you have put in a good deal, if not all, of your own assets, and that your own financial future is on the line. Bankers know that they're much more likely to be repaid from the success of the business if your entire financial life depends upon the business succeeding, and they will insist upon it. The fifth factor that the banker looks for is your credit, how well you've repaid any and all loans that you've made in the past. For bankers and lending officers, this is often the most important single part of the equation. It's often hard to assess your character or to have any guarantee with regard to your capacity. Bankers don't like to seize collateral in the event of a loan not being repaid, and even if you have invested a lot of capital in the business, there's no way that they can get their hands on that if things go wrong. The one thing that they can take to their lending committee is your credit rating, and they will do a detailed search of your credit history. That's why it's so important to keep it as clean as a whistle. Another way to minimize your cash requirements when you start your business is to use what is called supplier financing. Basically, this method consists of buying your products or raw materials from suppliers and then quickly selling your products to your customers before you have to pay your supplier for them in the first place. Many small companies have gotten started by arranging credit terms with the people who supply them with the essentials for their businesses. In order to do this yourself, you need a clean credit rating and a great personality. You need to go and visit your suppliers and sell them on the idea of extending credit to you. Sometimes they'll insist that you develop a 3 or 6 month payment history with them before they can extend more credit. Whatever it takes, resolve to build up an excellent supplier relationship. Develop personal friendships with the people who can make decisions on your line of credit. If you can buy and then sell before you have to pay for what you bought, everything you make is straight profit. This is often called kiting. Kiting is when you use someone else's money between when you've taken possession of the product and when you actually have to pay for it. Your ability to kite with your suppliers will be totally dependent upon your character and your credibility. That's why it's so important to guard your integrity as a sacred thing. Suppliers talk to each other and you will soon get a reputation that can either help or hurt you. Be sure it is one that helps you. It can make all the difference in how fast you achieve the business success that you desire. Another way to build your business with little cash is to ask your customer to pay for all or part of the order when he or she places the order. Whenever you make a sale, ask for a 25% or 50% down payment or retainer. If the customer tells you that they pay on a 30, 60, or 90-day basis, throw yourself on his mercy and explain that you're a little guy and that you're just starting off and that you would really appreciate it if he or she would pay you in advance. Many people who start businesses think that they're going to raise the money they need from venture capitalists. The fact is that venture capitalists are some of the sharpest business people in America. They look at about 100 business plans before they select one that they are willing to look at more closely. This means that 99% of all applications for venture capital are turned down for one reason or another. Venture capitalists usually look for 3 things before they'll consider lending to a company. The first is a proven success record of a minimum of 2 years. They want to study the track record of your organization to be sure that you know what you're doing and that you can deliver on your promises. Venture capitalists are very reluctant to fund a brand new business, although they'll do so on occasion if the second and third factors are in place. The second factor that venture capitalists look for is a complete business plan. Venture capitalists judge the business acumen and the quality of the entrepreneur based on how well he or she has prepared a business plan that is honest, factual, accurate, and complete. Many business schools and business colleges are training young business people on how to prepare business plans as a basic part of their educations. As I've said before, don't underestimate the importance of preparing a detailed business plan. The third factor that venture capital suppliers look for is a competent management team already in place. In fact, the management team has proven to be the critical factor in the success of many high-tech businesses in the last few years. For example, when the founders of Compaq Computers sat down and put together their business plan and began looking for venture capital, they had already assembled one of the best management teams in the computer industry. This carried an enormous amount of weight and enabled them to get the money they needed for a fast start. Because they had carefully thought through everything in advance and they had the skilled executives in place, Compaq Computers went on to become a $1 billion corporation faster than any other company in American business history. The major downfall in going to venture capitalists for funds is that they will demand a large piece of your company, and almost always they will require that you give them control should things go wrong. Many entrepreneurs have been forced out of their own companies by their venture capital suppliers when they failed to meet their projections. It's a general rule that entrepreneurs are too optimistic with regard to sales and profits. It's much better for you to triple your estimate and come in early than for you to be too enthusiastic and fail to meet your target. Both bankers and venture capitalists will judge the quality of your management by how well you meet the numbers that you've projected for yourself. Bankers especially start to become very nervous when an entrepreneur doesn't achieve his or her goals in sales, cash flow, and profitability. Venture capitalists will often step in quickly to take over the company if you miss 1 or 2 of your financial targets. In order to avoid getting yourself into this unpleasant situation, it's far better to be conservative about your projections in the first place. Whenever you borrow money from an institution or a bank or a venture capital firm, One of their requirements will be that you submit complete financial statements every single month. They will then sit down and compare your monthly financial results with your monthly financial projections. If your financial results are below your financial projections, they will start reaching for the plug. When a banker starts to get uneasy about your ability to hit your numbers, the banker's tendency is to panic so as to assure that there is something to grab before the loan is irretrievably lost. If you doubt this, just ask any banker how he or she feels about a business loan to a business person who is not meeting his or her numbers. One of the best attitudes towards starting and building your business is to treat your business like a turnaround. A turnaround is a business that has gotten into financial trouble through mismanagement. When a company gets into a tough financial situation, the top management is often replaced by what is called a turnaround specialist. This is an individual who can come in and act quickly to save the business. If you treat your company like a potential turnaround all the time, you'll always be doing the things that assure maximum profitability at minimum cost. Some of the things that a turnaround specialist will do when a business is running out of cash and is unable to make its payments or its payroll are the following. First, the specialist will make an objective assessment as to whether or not the conditions or declining sales are long-term or short-term. The specialist will always assume the worst and proceed as though the worst were going to happen. If sales are declining dramatically, the specialist will assume that this is part of a larger trend and will act accordingly. Second, the specialist will immediately act to preserve and guard cash at all costs. Throughout your entrepreneurial career, you must treat cash as king. Hold on to it carefully and part with it reluctantly. A business with cash can survive almost any storm, but a business that runs out of cash can go under in a matter of a few days. The specialist will then halt payments to suppliers wherever possible and accelerate payments from customers wherever possible. The turnaround specialist will even give discounts to customers for early payment. You should do the same thing. Get the longest possible terms in paying your suppliers and give the shortest possible terms in collecting from your customers. Give them 2% off if they pay within 15 days. Many companies are set up to automatically pay early in order to take all discounts. Number four, and this is something that's vitally important to you in any case, if you run into financial trouble, visit your banker immediately and tell him the situation. Never let your banker first find out that you're in trouble by finding out that you've missed a payment. Be sure that your banker is the first to know. I've spoken with several bankers on this subject, and they all say that their first instinct will be to do everything possible to help the business person who lets them know in advance. But when they find out after the fact, they tend to become both scared and angry, and you can lose a lot of your ability to negotiate with them. One of the things that has saved me with my bankers when the cash dried up was to renegotiate my loans temporarily and pay interest only. I would suspend all principal payments for a certain period of time. You see, as long as the borrower is making interest payments, the loan is considered a good loan on the books of the bank. The bankers will almost invariably allow you to go to interest-only payments if that's what you need to do in order to weather a period of cash shortage. The fifth thing that a specialist would do if negative conditions continue is to begin to lay off all non-essential staff and eliminate all non-essential expenses. They will cut everything to the bone rapidly. What you should learn from this is the motto, frugality, 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 and again frugality. In building your company, you should never have any non-essential staff or non-essential expenses. You should insist on spending only what you absolutely have to enable the business to function and to generate revenues from sales. The next step a turnaround specialist would take is to sell off assets as rapidly as possible. If you ever get into financial trouble, do an assessment of the assets you'd be willing to sell in order to save your business. Then, begin to sell them immediately. Don't wait until it's too late and you have to let things go at bargain basement prices. The two major reasons why businesses fail are 1, lack of sales, and 2, poor cost control. A loss of momentum in the sales department will cut off the incoming cash flow, causing the business to strangle. Poor cost control will cause too much money to be going out the back door, and even though sales are strong, the company can still go broke. The primary reason for poor cost control is too much inventory. Too much inventory is being ordered, and too little of it is being sold. Once you've taken possession of the inventory for resale, it's usually hard to give it back. It's essential that you run your business lean and mean, spending only what you have to spend in order to move forward. and carry only the inventory that you need in order to supply your customers in a timely fashion. Finally, the turnaround specialist would get in and roll up his sleeves and take control of all income and expenditures. He would insist upon approving every expense and signing every check. Nothing that did not absolutely have to be spent would be authorized. The turnaround specialist would be very hard-minded, even ruthless, with regard to outflows of cash. One of the smartest attitudes that you can develop is the attitude of the turnaround specialist. Continually look at your business from the outside and think of ways that you could make it more efficient. Think of ways to increase the cash flow and to cut down on the cash outgo. Practice frugality in everything you do, and don't lose money. The purpose of this session has been to open your mind to the fact that you don't need a lot of money to get started in a business of your own. What you need more than anything else is guts. If you want to be financially independent, you'll never achieve it working for someone else unless you become a senior executive of a large corporation. The most certain route to riches in America is to start and build your own successful business. And don't let lack of money hold you back. Many of the most successful businesses in America have been built by men and women who started with nothing or even deeply in debt. They didn't let that get in their way. They were so determined to take their idea for a product or service to the marketplace that they couldn't be stopped by a little thing like shortage of cash. They started their business in their basement or on their kitchen tables. They worked out of their homes and their cars. They worked in borrowed and rented spaces and in cold offices and warehouses. They negotiated with their bankers, their suppliers, and their customers to keep the cash coming in until they finally got the business off the ground. They persisted and they persevered and they hung in there until finally they started to make the profits they knew were possible. And they finally made it to business success and financial independence. What anyone else has done, you can do as well. If someone else you know has started his or her own business, if you really want to, you can start your own business too. If you are really serious about getting rich in America and the idea of entrepreneurship appeals to you, now is the time to begin taking steps to launch yourself in your own business. It will be the greatest adventure of your life. Now here's an exercise for you. Go through this session again and write out all the different ideas that you can think of to generate the cash you need to start your business. Look over all of your personal assets and assess your friends and relatives for how much you think you might be able to borrow from them. A good idea is to call up these people and tell them that you might need to borrow some money in the future, and would they be able to lend you a certain amount of money if you asked for it? This will give you a good idea of the resources that you can draw upon. Another good exercise is to get your credit rating into excellent shape and to begin building up your credit history at the bank that you choose to deal with. Take out short-term cash loans based on your character and your collateral, and then pay them back. Arrange for personal letters of credit, and if you have a home, if possible, take out a home equity line of credit. Make all of your necessary financial arrangements before you leave the security of your current job. Put yourself into field position for what they call the long ball. Every minute, every hour that you spend preparing and strategizing for the launching of your new business is going to save you 10 minutes or 10 hours in making your business successful. Nothing happens until a sale takes place. The ability to sell is the critical skill for success in entrepreneurship. If you can sell well, if you can plan your work and work your plan without supervision, then you have the basic skills necessary to be successful at starting and building your own business. Your ability to sell your product or service in sufficient quantities to make your business survive and prosper is absolutely vital to everything else that we've talked about. Fortunately, there's so much information available today on how to market and sell products and services that you can learn how to sell well no matter where you're starting from. In selling your product or service, the law of accumulation holds true. Everything counts. Every time your company, your products, your services, your people, your written or promotional materials come into contact with your customers or your prospective customers, they leave an impression, positive or negative. They are either helping you to make sales or they are taken away from your sales. A well-planned advertising and promotional sales strategy must be aimed at building the image and credibility of your company with every exposure. Your credibility, the believability of you, your company, and your products and services, is the foundation of your success in the marketplace. People must believe you and your company. they must trust you enough to select your product or service over those of your competitors. Almost everything that you do is selling you in some way. Start with your company name. This should be chosen carefully in order to convey a message. Small companies should clearly state the type of business in the name. For example, if you're an accountant, you should call your business John Jones Accounting Services, rather than John Jones Business Services or John Jones Enterprises. Be as specific as you can in the title. Only larger companies with established markets can use general names that don't refer to their specific product or service. IBM used to be called International Business Machines, a title that clearly told its customers what it sold and where it sold it. As International Business Machines became better known, it was able to reduce the name of the company to just its initials without losing its impact in the marketplace. Your stationery, your business cards, and your logo should state clearly what business you're in, and if possible, they should mention the products or services that you are offering. Everything that you produce should be selling all the time. It should have a message that enables a buyer to know what it is you sell, and if possible, give the buyer or customer enough information to take the next step toward a purchase. The location of your company's premises is terribly important if you're going to open up a retail business. In retail, the key to success is the same as in all of real estate: location, location, location. The most important element of location in a retail business store is the traffic count, the amount of traffic that goes by the front door. However, it's possible to make serious mistakes with regard to traffic. There are strip shopping centers that are located on what is called the drive-home side of the road. This means that people don't stop at these strip shopping centers because they're on the way home when they're not in the mood for shopping. There are some strip shopping centers on the drive-to-work side of the road that suffer from the same problem. They have lots of traffic going past, but the drivers are not in a mood to stop and shop. If you're not in the retail business, then the location of your premises is not particularly important. It's not necessary for you to locate in expensive office towers in order to make a positive impression on your prospective customer. Nobody's going to buy from you or not buy from you because you're paying a certain number of dollars per square foot in rent. Remember, the purpose of a business is to create a customer, and every dollar that you spend should be aimed at creating customers in some way. If what you're doing doesn't have an immediate impact on sales, then it's not a good promotional expense. Here are three questions that I put to anyone who has an idea for a new product or service. The first question is obvious. Is there a market? In other words, will people buy the product or service? In almost every case, the person with the idea will assure you that, yes, there is a market. They have spoken to people and they know of people who can and will purchase the product or service. My second question then is the market large enough? Are there enough people who will buy the product or service to make it a viable business idea? In many cases, businesses fall flat on this point. There are a number of people who will buy it, but the number is not large enough to justify starting a business to sell this product or service. My third question is often the killer. Is the market concentrated enough so that you can reach it in a cost-effective way with your advertising and sales activities? For example, there may be a market of 100,000 people in the United States who can buy or use a particular product or service. However, they may be spread out so that there's only one person per city, town, and village across the entire country. Even though the market exists, it may be virtually impossible to sell to that market in a cost-effective way. Which brings us to the question of advertising. Advertising is how you tell your customers that your product or service is available and what it will do for them and why they should buy it. Advertising is selling without a salesperson. Every advertisement should trigger the single response, "That's for me," from the person exposed to the advertisement, if he or she is a qualified customer. When you look at any advertisement, if it doesn't trigger the "That's for me" reaction, then it's a poor advertisement. The basic rule is that creative advertising sells, period. If it doesn't cause a person to want to act immediately to purchase your product, then it's a bad advertisement and you shouldn't spend any money on it. Many people who make their livings producing advertising for small companies are grossly incompetent. They produce what they and their associates consider to be clever or interesting advertising, but the advertising doesn't sell. The best way to test your advertising is to show it to people you know, including your spouse and your friends. If they do not immediately respond by saying that it's a great advertisement, then whatever you do, don't spend any money putting it in front of customers who don't even know you. Advertising, which is selling on paper or by radio or television, is an investment. Like any other investment, it should have an expected return. When you spend a dollar on advertising, you should expect to earn a profit on the sales that you get from that advertising. If you don't, then you should stop advertising in that medium or with that particular ad. For example, if you invest $1,000 in advertising and you earn a 25% profit on the sale of your products, if you sold $4,000 worth, you would make a $1,000 profit or break even on the advertising. However, since advertising is a risk, you should expect to make $3 or $4 or $5 in profit back from every dollar that you spend on advertising. In other words, if you spend $1,000 on advertising and you have a 25% profit on sales, you should expect to get $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 in additional sales as a result. If you don't, you're wasting your money. Before you advertise, determine how much you can afford to lose. Every advertisement is a gamble. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Sometimes your advertising will give you a great response, and sometimes your advertising will give you no response at all. And you must be prepared for no response at all when you run any ad in any medium at any time. Estimate and determine your high, your medium, and your lowest rate of expected return on an advertisement. When someone is trying to sell you an ad, show them your expected rate of return and ask if this rate is realistic. Often people who sell advertising will become very embarrassed when you ask this and will be unable to continue the conversation because they know that very few companies get the kind of returns on investment in advertising they need in order to justify the expense. A good rule when you advertise is to always pay cash. Never advertise on credit. Many entrepreneurs make the fatal mistake of thinking that they will pay for the advertisement with the profit they make from the sales that come as the result of the advertisement. This very seldom occurs. However, when you pay cash for your advertising, you always tend to think more carefully about the amount you're spending and how you're spending it than if you buy your advertising on credit. The places where you can advertise to get the best results are the following. First is the newspaper. But you only advertise in the newspaper if you're trying to cast a wide net and if your product or service generally appeals to a large number of people whom you could reach effectively in no other way. Newspaper advertising can be both very expensive and very effective. It can also be very expensive and not effective at all. The second medium you can use is radio. The key to advertising on the radio is to select the station and the program based on the demographic profiles of the listeners. For example, if you're offering a sporting product or you sell sporting goods, you'd advertise on a radio station that has a lot of sports coverage and which is listened to by a lot of people who use the type of products that you sell. The key here is to request accurate information from the radio station on their Nielsen ratings. The Nielsen ratings will tell you exactly how many people listen to that station, what their ages and occupations are, and what their general education and income levels are. The third form of advertising that you can consider is direct mail. The key advantage of direct mail is that you can make it very narrow and focused. You can buy carefully selected lists of specific customers who can and will buy your product or service. The key to using direct mail is to purchase a small number of names from a particular list and send out a test mailing to see what kind of response you get before doing a larger mailing through a larger list. Remember, the secret to successful advertising is test, test, test. The fourth form of advertising that a small business can use is television. With a television ad, your goal is to convey a single message and get the viewers to take a specific action, such as to pick up the phone or come in, within a specific time period. Small business people can never afford to do what is called institutional advertising. This form of advertising simply tells the public that you're in business and available if they would like to buy a product or service that you sell. The small business person must do focused advertising that gets results immediately. You can buy packages of television spots, but you should be prepared to spend as much as 20% of your television advertising budget on the actual production of the advertisement. Many companies will spend 50 cents of every dollar of television advertising just producing the commercial. If you skimp on the production quality of the commercial, you might end up losing all your money because the commercial may get you no response at all. There are other forms of advertising that you can use as well, but these are the most important for communicating with your customers. The others should only be used in conjunction with the first four. you can send out flyers to homes in the neighborhood or community where your business is located. This is a shotgun approach that usually has a low rate of return. You can advertise in special interest magazines. You can advertise in specific trade publications that go to a particular industry that may have need of your product or service. You can use transit advertising, advertising that appears on buses or taxis, and you can also use outdoor signs. The thing to remember is that these media are seldom effective. If you want to make your advertising effective, here are the questions that you need to answer while you're preparing your advertisement. First, determine exactly what is to be sold. Many newspaper advertisements created by advertising departments are so confusing that you are unsure exactly what it is they're trying to sell you. Second, determine to whom it is to be sold. Who's your customer? Who exactly are you aiming this advertisement at? Third, determine exactly what action you want your customer to take as the result of seeing this advertisement, and then ask your customer to take that action in the ad. End the ad with something like, "Pick up the phone and call us now," or "Come in before Saturday at 5 p.m. to take advantage of this special offer." Don't assume that your customer is going to figure out the required action for himself or herself. Be very specific and tell your customer what you want him or her to do. Fourth, determine what benefits you will offer to cause your customer to take action. You always have to be answering the question, "What's in it for me? What's in it for me? What's in it for me?" Remember, your customer is reading dozens of other ads. The benefits that you offer for taking action must be more attractive than those being offered by any of your competitors. Fifth, in writing an ad, keep one theme dominant, your unique selling proposition. Each advertisement should make one specific proposition to the buyer. It should convey one specific message so that when the buyer turns away from the advertisement, that message sticks in his or her mind. Finally, use straightforward, honest language that captures attention, creates interest, arouses desire, and asks for the sale. Now, here are some ideas on how you can get free publicity to help you sell more of your product or service. The basic rule is that if you want publicity, ask for it. Newspapers especially need an enormous amount of material to fill their pages day after day. Also, you should try to get onto radio and television. If you have something of human interest, especially something unusual, you can launch upon a program to get free publicity, and you'll be amazed at how much you get. I have personally obtained many tens of thousands of dollars of free publicity by doing the things that I'm about to recommend to you. Start off with what is called a publicity release or a press release. Mail it to every relevant medium in your market area. Go through the yellow pages and take down the names and addresses of every newspaper, including local, national, and community, every radio station, both AM and FM, and every television station, including community cable channels. Then, prepare a press release in the form of a letter to the editor on your stationery. It should be addressed to the newspaper and then the name Dear Editor, or the individual's name if you can get it, and should tell about your new business or something that your business is doing. You can send out a press release when you move to new offices, or when you introduce a new product or service, or upgrade an old product or service, or hire a new person, or even when you embark upon a new promotional campaign. Any one of these can be construed as news if you describe it properly. Write a 100-word description of your product or service, double-spaced. Include a good photograph of your product in use, or one of you delivering your product or service to your customers. Make your description short and factual. Don't try to entertain, but instead give interesting information on how it works. Use a good 3 or 4 word headline on your press release, like "New Business Breaks National Record," or "First Time in San Diego," or whatever the name of your own city is. At the top of the page, write "For immediate release." Send these press releases to magazines and to any other publications where it may be useful for you to get exposure. Make this press release an informative news release rather than an ad. Don't try to sell your product, just try to make it interesting and different, and if possible, put some kind of a twist on it. When you've written your press release, read it and ask, "Is this news?" News is something that is timely. It is something that has just happened or has some association or relevance to current events. If you can somehow make your product or service interesting and newsworthy, you can get lots of free publicity and you may trigger sales in quantities that will astonish you. If you're unsure about what newspapers, radio, or television stations to contact, go down to your local library and get a copy of the publication called Standard Rates and Data. This is a publication that comes out monthly and goes to every advertising agency. It contains a complete description of every advertising medium in your community, including its circulation, its demographics, its history, its size, its financial strength, and a whole lot of other information. Often, Standard Rates and Data will even give you the names of the people in charge of the various news departments that you can write to personally and specifically. For example, if you have an item that is for the home, you can write to the editor in charge of the home features department of a particular newspaper. If you can get onto a radio talk show, be sure to take along a list of questions for the interviewer to ask you. Make it easy for the interviewer to have you on the show. Be prepared to answer the questions with quick, punchy answers that are interesting for the radio listeners. When you get onto a television show, do exactly the same thing. Create a 10 or 12 question fact sheet to act as a prompter for the host of the show. Hosts of television interview shows are usually very quick on their feet. They can often glance at your list of questions, put it aside, and then shoot the questions at you for the next 30 minutes without missing a beat. When you get onto a television show, don't try to be an entertainer. Sell by giving good, useful information to the people listening. Remember, the person watching the television has a remote control in his or her hand. He or she is asking continually, "Why should I continue watching this show?" The person listening to the radio is asking, "Why should I continue listening to this station?" If you give useful and valuable information about how your product or service can benefit the listener, people will continue to stay tuned. Your adventure into entrepreneurship begins with a concept, with an idea for a product or service that you can sell at a profit in a competitive market. Everything that you do between coming up with the idea and the actual face-to-face meeting with the customer is preparing for the sale. The sale is the culmination of all your efforts. All of your market analysis, your development of financial projections, your market studies, your advertising, your promotion, your physical location, and your production of products and services are all in preparation for actually making the sale. The primary reason for business success in America is the ability to get the goods out of the woods, to sell the product or service at the point of contact with the final customer, and get paid for it. There are about 21 different ways for you to sell your product or service. You can focus on one of these ways, or you can use several of them. Most companies, however, only use one or two. The first and most popular form of selling in America is direct selling. This is person-to-person selling, where a salesperson goes out and meets with a customer, makes a presentation, closes a sale, gets the order, and leaves with a check. This will always be the most popular kind of selling, and for you to be successful in your business, you're going to have to become very, very good at this kind of personal, direct selling one-on-one. There's a simple formula for selling that clearly describes the four basic parts of the sales process. Most salespeople are not properly trained in the methods of professional selling. Fully 95% of them could sell much, much more of their products or services if they were better trained and if they did what they were then taught to do. The four-step sales formula, upon which all sales are based, is referred to as AIDA, or the letters A, I, D, and A. The first letter A stands for attention. Every sales effort must first succeed in getting the prospect to stop doing or thinking whatever it is he or she is doing or thinking and pay attention to your message. Unless you have grabbed the attention of the prospect, the rest of the sales effort is useless. This is equally applicable to any form of advertising or promotion as well. We often call this preoccupation breaking. The first words that you say should break the preoccupation of the customer. The best way for you to do this is to ask a question or make a statement that refers to a benefit or advantage that the prospect would like to enjoy. The second letter I stands for interest. You arouse interest by showing the prospect how your product or service works or what it does. You show the prospect how it is new or cheaper or different from other products or services. The interest phase is where you talk about the features of the product. The third letter, D, stands for desire. You arouse the desire to buy a product or service by explaining the benefits that the customer will enjoy as the result of purchasing. Features arouse interest, but benefits are what arouse the desire to purchase. Two of the most powerful emotions that cause people to act are the fear of loss and the desire for gain. Many very effective sales presentations focus on showing the customer how much he or she will gain by going ahead or how much he or she will lose by not buying. There are other powerful buying motives or needs around which a benefit-oriented presentation can be structured. The need for self-preservation or safety is a powerful motivator, especially for children or a person's family. The need for security is a motivator, as is the need for prestige or for success. People are motivated to do things that improve their health. The desire for riches and power are strong motives to act. The desire for companionship is a motivator. The desire for social status or popularity will motivate people to purchase a product or service. The desire for self-esteem or pleasure is a motivator. Perhaps the biggest mistake that salespeople make is that they talk too much about what the product or service is, and they talk too little about how the customer will benefit personally from the use or enjoyment of the product or service. The fourth part of the sales presentation is the second A, and it stands for action. Action means getting agreement from the client or customer that he or she wants to own or enjoy the product or service. This is also called closing the sale or getting the order. In the final analysis, your ability to get a binding decision, to overcome hesitation and procrastination, is the real mark of how effective you are as a salesperson, and that in turn will determine the success of your business. Fortunately, the close of the sale is simply the natural conclusion of an organized sales presentation, but it takes place only when sufficient buying desire has been aroused. One of the most important responsibilities of the entrepreneur is to become excellent at selling. The biggest mistake that I see repeatedly is an entrepreneur who has an idea for a product or service, but who has no desire or willingness to go out and sell it. They approach me at my seminars and ask me where they can find good salespeople. I tell them that unless they are good at selling or they have a partner who is excellent in sales, they have very little chance in succeeding in business. Ideas for products and services are a dime a dozen. It's the ability to sell them that transforms an idea into a business. Here are five questions that you must answer in the course of a sales presentation. Remember, customers are just like everyone else. They are lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient. They all want more security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, fulfillment, and power. They are also in a hurry, busy, and preoccupied. Taking all of this into consideration, the very first question that you must answer when you approach a prospect, either in person or through advertising, is, "Why should I listen to you?" Your opening remarks or headline must answer the question, "Why should I listen to you?" You must grab the prospect's attention and hold that attention until you've had an opportunity to tell the prospect why it is that he or she should consider your offer. Once you have the prospect's attention, the next question you must answer is, "What is it?" The answer to this question, "What is it?" is your product or service and what it does and what it can do for the customer. The third question you must answer is, "Who says so?" It's a general fact that customers don't believe or pay much attention to the claims of salespeople or of advertising. What they do believe is when someone else says that your product or service will do what you say it will do. You need independent proof of some kind or even a demonstration to show your customer that what you say about your product or service is true. The fourth question the prospect wants the answer to is, "Who else has done it?" Nobody wants to be a guinea pig. Nobody wants to be the first one to try a new product or service. To overcome skepticism and to answer this question, you need testimonials in the form of letters from satisfied clients or lists of customers who are already using your product or services, and even photographs showing customers using your products or services. Good testimonials are extremely valuable in overcoming customer skepticism and building trust and credibility. The final question that the customer wants the answer to is, "What do I get?" or "What's in it for me?" You answer this question by focusing on benefits, by showing the customer how his or her most pressing need for enjoyment, satisfaction, gain, saving, security, or any other benefit your product offers can be met by using your product or service. The secret to successful selling is to ask questions, to probe carefully, to listen attentively, and to find out what the prospect wants or needs to accomplish. Your job is to find out what is called his or her hot button. The hot button is the key benefit the customer wants or the main need that the customer has that will cause him or her to buy your product or service. Often, this is simply your competitive advantage or your unique selling proposition. But you must find out what a particular customer wants or needs and then demonstrate that your product or service will give it to him. So personal selling, face-to-face, is the first and most popular way that products and services are sold in America. Many of the great fortunes in America and many of the great entrepreneurial success stories are based on the ability of a single person to go out and convince people that they should buy and use a particular product or service. The second way that you can sell your product is through retail sales, in your own store, or through other retailers. Many entrepreneurs get the exclusive market rights for a product in a particular geographical area, and then simply supply those products to retailers in the area. Often, entrepreneurs and business people will manufacture a new product for sale through retail stores. This is perhaps the second most popular route to entrepreneurial success in the sale of new or improved products. Before you commit yourself to any product that's to be sold at retail, it's essential that you visit as many retail establishments as possible that you think would be candidates to sell your product. Speak to their buyers and ask them what they think about your product. Ask them how much they will pay and what else they have that would compete with your product. Remember, fully 80% of retail products developed by major corporations fail every year. You can't be too careful in doing your market research before you commit yourself irrevocably to a particular product. The third way that you can sell is through the newspaper to generate direct responses, either in person or in the form of telephone inquiries that you can follow up directly. But all newspaper advertising is aimed at getting the customer to act now. Not tomorrow, not on the weekend, but immediately. And if it doesn't achieve this goal, either change the ad or stop the advertising altogether. A fourth way that you can sell is through direct mail. Direct mail allows you to pinpoint your market. Success in direct mail depends upon your having a good mailing list of qualified buyers and your having a product that is specific to that particular group of customers. There are thousands of lists available in the United States, and there are even corporations that do nothing but assemble and sell mailing lists. You can often find these corporations in the yellow pages under the heading of mailing list brokers. You can get lists of every kind of person who has ever engaged in every kind of activity imaginable. You can get lists broken down by zip code, by income grouping, by the amount that they spend each year in direct mail, and by 100 other categories. But, as I said earlier, when you decide to use direct mail, be sure to test both the offering and the list before you start to mail in volume. The fifth way that you can sell is through mail order. You can place small ads in selected or specialized publications that appeal to your customer group. Mail order sales account for billions of dollars in sales each year. If you're successful in placing smaller ads, you may eventually get to the point where you can produce and mail out color catalogs such as Land's End, Eddie Bauer, Spiegel, Sharper Image, or any of the catalogs that you probably receive at home. A sixth way to sell products is through a party plan. There are some product lines such as Tupperware, beauty products, specialty food lines, and specialty clothing that can be sold in homes by having the housewife invite her friends in for a presentation. The hostess then receives a premium or a commission on all sales. Many small businesses have become large businesses by recruiting people to sell through a party plan. If your product line lends itself to this kind of selling, you could experiment in your own community or your own neighborhood and see how well it works. A seventh way to sell a product is through door-to-door or office-to-office sales. This form of cold calling is a powerful method of direct selling if the product is right and the sales presentation is effective. Hundreds of millions of dollars worth of encyclopedias, books, and other educational products have been sold door-to-door. This is not particularly easy selling, but much of the fundraising activity in the United States, especially in organizations like the Girl Scouts, is based on this form of door-to-door selling. The eighth way that you can sell your product or service is through co-op mailings. Many large mailing firms or other companies will enclose your product flyer with their mailing or invoices in exchange for a share of the gross sales. If you have an American Express, MasterCard, or Visa, you'll often receive these co-op mailings with your monthly bill. The only cost to you is usually the cost of producing the mailing. The company who is sending out the billing gets their share of revenues from the successful sales of the product. The advantage to you is that you don't have to commit large sums of money until sales start to be made. The ninth way that you can sell a product and many services is through the government. Governments in America, federal, state, county, and municipal, are the biggest single customers in the entire nation. They spend hundreds of billions of dollars every year, and most of these dollars are spent with outside suppliers. If your product or service is applicable, you should approach various government offices at various levels and find out who makes the buying decisions. Many companies find opportunities to manufacture products and create services for government departments because of the volume in which they purchase. You can become financially independent if you can develop a product that can be used by a great number of government offices or departments. The tenth way that you can sell is through sales representatives, or what are called manufacturer's representatives. There are many professional salespeople who work on commission selling several product lines in related areas. You can advertise for these manufacturer's representatives in the local newspapers. There's no cost to you for having this kind of professional sales force unless and until they make a sale. The weakness with manufacturers' representatives is that because they represent several products, they seldom focus their energies on a single product unless it's very appealing to their market. You will also have to pay them a higher than average sales commission. But nonetheless, when you're starting out, this is a terrific way to get people selling your product all over the country. The 11th way you can sell your product is through chain stores. Many chain stores have hundreds of outlets, and you only need to sell your product to one buyer in the head office, and it will go into hundreds of stores automatically. The 12th way that you can sell is through discount stores. Discount stores prefer to carry products at below normal retail. Sometimes you can repackage or relabel your products for sale to discount stores so it won't hurt your sales at full retail by other methods. Sometimes you can change the name or change the packaging or change the size, quality, or quantity of your product to sell them in large quantities to stores such as Kmart, Walmart, and Price Club or Costco. The 13th place where you can sell your product is through supermarkets. Supermarkets carry a lot of non-food items, and if you can sell your product to a buyer for a chain of supermarkets, often they will put your product onto the shelves in hundreds of outlets. The 14th place where you can sell your product is to department stores. The product buyers in department stores are very astute, and if they like your product, they can become major customers for you. Some of the most successful products in America achieve their high sales volume by being sold to and through department stores. The 15th outlet for your product is through wholesalers. Many wholesalers will agree to carry your product to sell along with their other lines direct to retail buyers. In order to sell to wholesalers, your product pricing must be structured in such a way that both the wholesaler and the retailer can make the kinds of profits that are expected in your industry. Of course, you will have to sell to wholesalers at below wholesale price. Everyone has to make a profit. The 16th way that you can sell your product, if it's appropriate, is as a premium. Many companies will purchase your product to give away as a prize or as an award or bonus for purchasing something else. Sometimes a magazine company will give your product as a bonus for purchasing a subscription. A very successful promotion I saw recently included a book of coupons for McDonald's if the customer opened up an account at a local bank. You can use your imagination to go out into the marketplace and find companies that could increase their business by giving away one of your products to new customers. The 17th way that you can sell your product or service is as an advertising specialty. Companies may purchase your product to imprint with their names and give away as gifts. You see this in the form of ashtrays, pens, frisbees, caps, and pocket calculators. Every year you receive calendars in the mail from your suppliers. These are advertising specialties. The calendar manufacturers went to the various companies and got them to purchase the calendars as business gifts to help build customer loyalty. This advertising specialty field, by the way, is a $500 million industry today, and it embraces literally thousands of products. The 18th way that you can sell your product or service is by franchising. Many businesses have the capacity to be franchised and rolled out to other areas. Franchise businesses account for more than 40% of retail sales in America today. I described the keys to franchising in the first session in this part of the program. The 19th way to sell your product or service is at trade shows. Buyers from thousands of companies attend trade shows each year to find new products to offer through their wholesale and retail outlets. There are trade show directories that you can get, sometimes at your local library. Look up all the different trade shows that might carry products similar to yours, that might be attended by people who could buy your product or even your service. The 20th way that you can sell your product or service is through shows, fairs, and expositions. you can exhibit your products at conventions and at fundraising shows. Almost every major convention in America has an exhibit area that it rents out. The people at these conventions, whether they are wholesalers, retailers, oil well drillers, insurance salespeople, corporate managers, and so on, all visit these exhibits to look for new products and services that they can use in their businesses. The 21st way that you can sell your product is to market it to charities and fundraisers. You can often sell your product to charitable organizations who will then sell it as a fundraiser to their members. Many companies have generated tremendous sales by selling their products to a chamber of commerce or by manufacturing and producing candy, nuts, toys, or other items that can be sold to raise funds for nonprofit organizations. To repeat what I said at the beginning, nothing happens until a sale takes place. Selling is the core function of the entrepreneur. You may only have an average product in an average market at an average or even above average price, but if you can sell, you can still build a successful business. There are endless combinations of ways that you can get your product to your customers, but in the final analysis, someone has to ask someone to make a buying decision. You have to be willing to ask the customer to give you the order. You have to be willing to close. You have to be willing to risk your ego in exchange for building your business. But if you're willing to sell aggressively, to sell continually, if you're willing to sell from morning to night, then you have what it takes to become an entrepreneur and to build your fortune in the American free enterprise system. Now here's an exercise for you. Take your business idea, the one that you arrived at as a result of the exercise at the end of the previous session, and begin to work out an advertising and sales strategy for your product or service. How will you name your company? How will you sell your product or service? Which of the 21 different ideas that we talked about seems to be most appropriate for you? How will you advertise your product or service? And what will be the cost of the various advertising media? What is there about your product or service that makes it interesting, that makes it different? What could you do using this feature to get free publicity for your product or service? Who could you talk to get more information? With regard to your product or service idea, answer the 5 questions a customer would ask in a written essay form. Why should I listen to you? What is it? Who says so? Who else has done it? What do I get, or what's in it for me? If you can answer all those questions satisfactorily on a sheet of paper, and then give the sheet of paper to someone else and have them become interested in purchasing your product or service, you may be on your way to entrepreneurial success.